Once you reach the speed of automobiles and trains, you arrive at a point of rupture where we really become disconnected from the environment. It becomes a blur, a literal blur. And I think that that rupture leaves in us a desire for something, a desire for context and a desire for connection to the environment. And I think that's a big hole in our psyche that we're trying to fill in all sorts of ways.
Join explorers and travelers on their journeys and discover distant places and fascinating cultures. From the highest peaks and densest jungles into the heart of adventure, this is Unfolding Maps with Eric Lawrence.
Trails can be found in virtually every part of this vast, strange, mercurial, partly tamed, but still shockingly wild world of ours. Throughout the history of life on Earth, we've created pathways to guide our journeys, transmit messages, refine complexity, and preserve wisdom. At the same time, trails have shaped our bodies, sculpted our landscapes, and transformed our cultures. In the maze of the modern world, the wisdom of trails is as essential as ever. With the growth of ever more labyrinthine technological networks, it will only become more so. To deftly navigate this world, we will need to understand how we make trails and how trails make us.
This was a section from the preface of the book that we are going to talk about in this episode. This book could be summarized like this. An author hiked the Appalachian Trail and then got obsessed with the history and creation of trails. Some might say that sounds a bit boring, but the good news is it isn't. Instead, On Trails by Robert Moore is, in my humble opinion at least, one of the most fascinating outdoor books of the past years. In it, Robert explores how trails help us to understand the world. He discusses how the wisdom of trails link together all species, from ants to elephants to hiking paths that span continents and from interstate highways to the internet. The book has been chosen as one of the best books of the year by the Boston Globe, the Seattle Times, National Post, New York, The Telegraph, and Booklist, and so on and so on. And it received the National Outdoor Book Award, besides others. It's really just a great read. I really highly recommend it because it covers a seemingly simple topic, trails, but spans an arc from the dawn of animal life to the digital era, and from science to history, philosophy and nature writing, and so much more. And so I'm really looking forward to this conversation with Robert Moore, which starts right now. Enjoy. Hi, Robert. Welcome to Unfolding Maps. Thank you very much for joining me.
Hi, Eric. Thanks so much for having me.
I'd like to start with a question that maybe is a little bit profound and also a bit challenging to answer right from the get-go, but let's give it a try. We are gonna talk about trails today because you wrote a book on trails, and I'd like to ask you, what makes, in your eyes, a trail elegant or beautiful?
That is a surprisingly difficult question to answer because the answer depends on what the trail is striving to accomplish, right? If a trail is striving to be as expeditious as possible, as fast as possible, then, you know, it's pretty easy to define elegance. It's a straight trail, or it's a trail that avoids as many obstacles as possible. But as we continue to make trails in ever more aesthetic ways or more philosophical ways, the elegance becomes a lot trickier. When you're on a modern hiking trail, that trail is winding back and forth up and down the mountain, going over staircases and even perhaps up steel rungs bolted into the side of a rock. And it can look kind of ugly, but the beauty of it, the elegance of it, is in fact that it's preserving the sustainability of the trail, that trail will last longer because of that design. So I think that my definition of elegance is the degree to which a trail has evolved to its ends. You know, it's a highly evolved trail. That's how I see elegance, as a form of evolution.
Nice, yeah. So besides other things, it depends on the evolution of the trail. It depends on the objective with which we follow the trail. In an interview, I believe I've heard you say before, trails are an expression of desire. That's also a very nice way to put it. So that's what trails are all about, right?
It is, yeah. I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with that line, the phrase desire lines, which are pathways of desire, which are these trails across city parks or across college campuses. They have all sorts of words for them in other countries. I'd be curious to know if there's a word for it in German. I know in Holland they refer to them as elephant paths, olifantenpad. But these are the trails that just emerge by people walking across a park because they want to get from one side to the other and they don't want to follow the sidewalk. And it organically emerges and organically evolves. I think all trails are reflections of desire in that way, but those are really the ones that are most obvious.
I think there actually is a word in German, if I understood the English words correctly and now find the right association. It's called Trampelpfade, which means, as a literal translation, it would say like trampling pathways. So by people yes. like trampling left and right and through the midst of the bush, these little pathways, which look rather random, they are created.
Yeah, I love that German has so many different words for specific types of trails and pathways and roads. You know, I know reading Heidegger, he was always talking about the Holzwege. I'm probably saying that word wrong, but the sort of lumber path or the path that's taken to go cut down trees. And there are multiple, the field path, all of these different phrases yeah. for specific types of trails. And I know I had to struggle with it in the German translation of my book as well, because I kept using the phrase dirt road in English, and in German, apparently there are like five or six different words for dirt road. And so my translator, every time I said dirt road, would come back to me and say, what kind of dirt road? And I'd say, well, it was little pieces of gravel. And he'd go, oh, okay, that's a different type of dirt road. And so it was incredibly time consuming and never even crossed my mind yeah. that there would be multiple words for dirt road.
Yeah, just as a little intersection for our German listeners, your book will be released in German with the Suhrkamp Verlag, I believe, in 2021. So there's reason to look forward to that, but I also highly appreciate the English version, of course. Yes, trails. You started, as far as I know, to really extensively think about trails in the year 2009, so quite a few years ago. What happened in this year? What made you or what prompted you to think about trails more than ever before?
Yeah, so in 2009, I went and I thru-hiked the Appalachian Trail in the classic way that many Americans do. I started in Georgia and I hiked north to Maine, all in one go, a sort of classic through hike starting in March and ending in August. And the reason why most people do that is because you're supposed to be following the spring as it thaws going north. You know, the classic account of the very first through hike is called walking with spring. That's exactly what you're doing. You're trying to follow this warm bubble of air north and not let it get too hot or too cold. But it just didn't work out for me that year. It was one of the rainiest years in the history of the Appalachian Trail. And so we walked for days and days and days. And as I say in the opening pages of the book, I just kept my head down. I was looking, staring right at that trail, watching its every nuance. And I started to think about, what is a trail? I mean, almost in a paranoid way, like, who made this and who's controlling me? Because I had to go wherever that trail wanted me to go. And so I was forced to think all of these big thoughts about trails that I don't think I would have thought otherwise.
Yeah, this understanding or realization that someone or something made you follow this trail is actually pretty interesting, I think. You write in a book, quote, most of us saw this hike as an interlude of wild freedom before we re-entered the ever-tightening hedge maze of adult life. But complete freedom, it turned out, is not what the trail offers. Quite the opposite. A trail is a tactful reduction of options. The freedom of the trail is riverine, not oceanic. So this actually shows what you just talked about, that the freedom that the trail is supposed to provide you with actually is very relative, right?
Yeah, that's an excellent way of putting it. I think that when we think of adventure, at least in America, we tend to think of it in a sort of pathless way, that you're going to be out there in the wild, finding your own way with total freedom. And here in the United States, it's, I'll just say, because I'm actually currently in the United States, I'm in Canada, but in the United States, that word freedom has a sort of mythic power. It has a great deal of power invested in it, to the degree that I think it actually obscures a lot of our understanding. And so one of the interesting things to begin thinking about with trails is what kind of freedom do they present? You know, we think freedom is a good thing, but actually total freedom is completely overwhelming. It can lock you up, as I describe in my book. The freedom of the trail is the reduction of all the extraneous ways of going across those mountains, which wouldn't work. It's the freedom of being able to go with the flow of the trail that someone else has created for you. And that becomes very clear as you walk, because everything sort of falls away. You start shedding. I wasn't even carrying a map by the time I finished the trail. I was just carrying this little guidebook, which I would tear the pages out of and burn every night to make it lighter. You know, I had almost no way of navigating save the trail. And it was fine because the trail was there. The trail got me there. And that creates this lightness of spirit and a lightness of body and baggage. And that's very freeing in its own way.
How did you originally get into hiking?
So I began hiking when I was 10 years old. I come from a very un-outdoorsy family. My mother was, both my parents are from Texas, and my mother was a great horseback rider when she was young. She grew up, her family had a ranch, and she was a champion horseback rider. My dad is not. He is a guy who likes to stay inside. He won't even eat at a sidewalk cafe. And so my upbringing was not terribly outdoorsy, but when I was 10 years old, my parents sent me off to this summer camp in Maine for 6 weeks. And something I don't mention in the book is that on the third day of the summer camp, the camp actually burned down. There was an explosion, a propane tank exploded, and this little island called Pine Island burned down, and we had to jump into boats and kayaks and sailboats and flee the island. And so I thought, you know, great, we're going home, right? I wasn't particularly fond of summer camp anyway. I wanted to go home and hang out and play Tetris, but the camp director didn't send anyone home. We all just stayed for the whole summer. It's still, in hindsight, the strangest thing. I think because everyone's parents had already made plans. You know, they were going on vacation because their kids were gone for 6 weeks. So we stayed behind and we lived in these big canvas tents, which the Army or the National Guard had provided us with. And we were like little refugees. We were donated clothes. We were donated hiking gear. Everything was donated to us because we lost all of our possessions. And so that year they sent out tons of hiking trips because we had really nothing else to do. So that was my very first hiking trip, was maybe, I don't know, a week or maybe a week and a half into my first year at summer camp. They sent me to Mount Washington, this mountain in New Hampshire. And I just hated it. I hated every moment of the first day. I remember trying to make faces at other people as they walked down the trail, like, help me, you know, like this sort of as if I were a hostage, because my backpack hurt and my boots hurt. I didn't see the point of it. They're making us eat this terrible food, you know, burned oatmeal for breakfast. And it was awful. And then the second day, we were supposed to go summit the mountain, but it started to rain. And so instead of going for the summit, we dropped our packs at the lean-to and we just did a day hike. And we walked around, and I remember it so profoundly because I was wearing this rubber rain poncho. And it was really warm and light. You know, that feeling of walking with no backpack when you've been walking with a heavy pack is so nice. Mm-hmm. And we just traversed around the edge of the alpine zone, and we're looking up at this peak that was lost in the clouds. And that was actually when I first encountered the Appalachian Trail. We stumbled on that hike across an intersection with the Appalachian Trail. My counselor told me that this trail goes all the way to Georgia, which, you know, for people who don't know, is on the other side of the United States. It's on the southern end of the United States.
Yeah.
And that was just a phenomenal, impossible thought to me, that something could stretch for that far, this one trail, and just by stepping on it, you could walk that whole length. It was really a magical moment.
And that intrigued you and more or less, yeah, stuck with you in the back of your mind until at some point, many years later, you decided to actually do the Appalachian Trail. Why did you originally want to follow it? What did you hope to get out of it for you?
Well, I think as a kid, it was very romantic. You know, you would meet these through hikers, and they seemed like such romantic figures. They all had these trail names, which were made up, you know, kind of code names for themselves. And they had these long beards, and they were all scratched up and skinny. And they'd done this thing that I thought was impossible. So it was very heroic to me. But as I got older, I think I started to see the Appalachian Trail as a kind of as an interregnum, you know, a moment to pause in before I launched myself into my career, where I could really get my priorities straight and have this long moment of walking meditation in a way, you know, just to walk and be quiet with myself. And I didn't bring any music or anything to listen to. I just wanted to be out there in the wild for 5 months and really try to learn something or find something about myself or about the world, about the wilderness. I didn't know what I was going to find, but I think I saw it almost as a kind of a pilgrimage.
Of course, there are many things about the Appalachian Trail itself that we could talk about the community, about the whole logistics on how to ensure that you have sufficient amount of food and so on and so on. But we want to get to the trails and to the book itself. Just one or two more questions on the AT. What was the biggest challenge for you in completing it?
I think that the biggest challenge for anyone, I was lucky to not get injured. I was starting out in fairly good health and I was young and I had done enough research to have the right gear starting out. So a lot of the challenges that face someone like, say, Bill Bryson in A Walk in the Woods weren't there for me, thankfully. And that was that made the beginning of the trail much easier. The hard part for me came near the end, where you just start to wear out. Your body starts to wear down and you've run out of, you know, any excess fat supply. So you're hungry and tired all the time. And if it's raining like it was when I was hiking, you start to get this kind of malaise where you think, why am I doing this? Like, what is the point of this? It really becomes a mental struggle that you have to push through day after day, waking up and walking every single day without break for months. You know, I mean, I think I took 2 or 3 days off for 5 months.
Wow.
And so that kind of persistence is really difficult over that sustained amount of time, because you start to question everything about why you're out there and why you can't just go home and sleep in a bed, you know, which is something that Bill Bryson describes very, very well, is that the allure of that. And then near the very end, I started to acquire this kind of paranoid fascination with the idea that I would become injured. You know, I thought, I'm so close. I've walked for 4.5 months. I'm only 200 miles away. I'm going to trip and I'm going to break my ankle and it's going to, prevent me from reaching the end. And so I began knocking on wood, sort of superstitiously, like dozens of times a day. It almost became a kind of obsessive compulsive thing where every time this idea would pop into my head, I would go over. Fortunately, there's a lot of wood on the Appalachian Trail, so I never was more than a few steps from a tree. But those were my chief challenges, I think.
So you started to become obsessed with knocking on wood. You started to question why you're actually doing it and why you don't just stop. But eventually, yeah, you continued and eventually you finished it. And that, of course, leads to the question, did you feel that after you had finished it, did you feel in any way transformed? Do you feel that doing this was transformative for you in any way?
You know, it's an interesting question, because I did feel transformed by the time I reached the end. Perhaps not to the degree I thought I would. You know, I hadn't achieved some state of enlightenment or something like that. But what I had done is, as I described before, I'd shed a lot of baggage. You know, I felt very light. I felt very mentally light and very physically light. And I knew that I didn't need a lot of things to live, you know, to subsist. I didn't have a lot of worries, really. I mean, my only worry was just walking each day. And so I arrived at the end of the trail feeling great, and I did feel transformed. And I did have some clarity of where I wanted to do with my life. But the challenge is that once you return home, you transform back. You know, we are all products of our environment, and we forget that after you finish this grand journey, you got to go home to the same situation you were in before. And if you don't change your situation, you're probably going to turn back into the person you were before. And this is really difficult. This is probably the hardest thing for Appalachian Trail through hikers to learn. They call it the post-hike blues, something like that, that they become very depressed afterwards because they think they're a new person and they go home and they turn back into the old person. And that's a really profound lesson, I think, for people to learn, is that one adventure is not going to change your life. Changing your life is a much slower, harder process.
And it also doesn't happen automatically after doing something adventurous. The adventure itself can, at best, probably be an initial spark, right? That provides some inspiration. Exactly. Or some new context, some new frame of mind, some new benchmark. How did you try to incorporate what you had learned and the clarity that you gained? How did you try to incorporate it into your life back home?
Well, what I tried to do was to strip my life down the way I had while I was on the trail, right? Because the thing you learn hiking on a long trail, on any through hike, is to essentially become a minimalist. How mm-hmm. to shave all of your possessions down to the bare minimum, including some people, you know, sawing the handle off of their toothbrush or cutting the zippers off of their jackets. People go to all sorts of strange lengths to minimize the weight on their back. But I thought I could live like that as well, right? So I came home and I had like two plates and two bowls and two forks and two spoons and very, very few possessions. And I think that this was an ethos that was in the air at the time and to some degree still is, this idea of minimalism, that we don't need as much. And if you don't need as much, it won't cost as much and it won't take as much of your time. But the challenge is if you're not very strict with yourself, that stuff just creeps back in. You know, people give you gifts. You go and you actually now you need a third bowl because you have a friend over, you know, and you need three bowls for people to have dinner. And slowly, year by year, these things accrete back. And the same with your body. You know, if you're not really careful about your diet and exercise, suddenly you put on 5-10 pounds after you get home, and you put on 20 pounds because you're still eating like you were when you were on the trail, which was an enormous amount of food when you're through hiking. And this, you know, this just happens. You slowly, these things creep back in. And so trying to adhere to a philosophy of minimalism is so much harder. It's so nice to think about, but it's so much harder to do in real life. But what I think I really had done was to start to think about how our environment shapes us, right? Because I moved from the Appalachian Trail to the East Village of New York City. I was attending grad school. And I it was very, very clear to me how that environment was shaping my brain and my body. It was because the contrast was so stark. And I think that got me thinking more broadly about how all of us are shaped by the spaces and the structures that we live within.
Yeah, I would like to talk about exactly that in a bit, maybe towards the end of our conversation. But what you just said about minimalism and reduction and so on, you also put it very nicely, I think, in the epilogue of your book. You write, "In walking, we acquire more of less." And I think that's a very nice summary why we walk, why we hike, or at least why some of us do that. And yeah, what can be the gift of hiking?
Yeah, and I think it's telling that the cultures that really cherish or even fetishize walking and minimalism are the ones that are very wealthy, right? That we have a great deal of goods and a great deal of comforts, and mm-hmm. so we actually want to shed those things. It feels good to us. In the same way, when you're in a sauna, it feels good to go jump in a freezing ocean, yeah. whereas normally it wouldn't feel good at all. You know, that we need that contrast in our lives. And so you find that these philosophies around hiking and walking and you know, doing more with less start to pop up once we achieve a certain level of comfort. You know, the indigenous groups that I've had the blessing to be around in traditional societies don't tend to think a whole lot about walking as a leisure activity or as something to aestheticize. It's just the way they get from here to there. And if they don't have a lot of things, it's because they don't want to carry them around or they just don't have access to them. You know, there's not a philosophy of minimalism. They're not going around writing books about it if you go to Papua or somewhere.
Yeah, in the book you talk about a trip you did to Tanzania, I believe, and you talk about how the local tribes reacted to meeting hikers like you.
Yeah, they called us people with heavy luggage looking for problems. That was the local term for. They also called Westerners sexless turtles because they thought that we all looked like turtles with the big backpacks on our backs, and that the men and women looked the same. But the people with heavy luggage looking for problems is a perfect encapsulation of the way they saw us, right? Because there would be this big mountain and there would be a path going to the right of it and a path going around to the left of it. And the Americans would walk straight up the mountain, you know, with these heavy, heavy bags on their back. And the Maasai would look at us like, what are you doing? Why would you seek out that kind of hardship on purpose? Life is hard enough.
And that brings me back to the Appalachian Trail, where life also was pretty hard and led you to ask yourself many different questions. We already talked about it. Of course, very, very specific questions. Why am I doing this? Should I give up? Will I break my ankles? But also questions a little bit more going into, almost a philosophy and relating to the trail that you have been following for such a long time. We already talked about how you started to think about the trail and about the freedom, but also the restrictions it provided. How and when did these and other questions lead to the thought to develop a book trying to answer these questions?
Well, it's funny. The way that the book initially started was completely different. I had set myself the goal of writing a book about the Appalachian Trail, about my thru hike, in a way that would try to capture elements of the thru hiker's experience that were not captured by the one book everyone has read about the Appalachian Trail, which is A Walk in the Woods.
By Bill Bryson. You already mentioned it.
By Bill Bryson. Yeah, that is very funny and very, he's very self-effacing. He's actually a great book. He does a great job with capturing history. But there's an element of the poetic and an element of the almost the spiritual. I'm not a highly religious person, but it's a rather spiritual experience to spend that amount of time walking, through the woods that he doesn't capture at all. And so I thought there's a book that's a bit more in line with something that, say, Annie Dillard would have written in Walking the Appalachian Trail that no one has written. And I spent about a year trying to write that book and telling people about that book, and it just never really caught anyone's interest. The problem with the Appalachian Trail in writing a book about it is, A, not that much happens. So unless you have a really eventful hike, there's not that much material. It's mostly just you walking.
That's why I was so impressed by Bill Bryson's book back then, because it was so entertaining, so, gripping. Of course, he benefited a lot from his hiking mate and their interactions, which made it very funny. But I know what you mean. Superficially, it's a tough job to create some real exciting sparkles in there.
It is, and also you're lashed to this kind of linearity. You have to follow the trail day by day and state by state. And something else that Bryson does is he skips around, and that cuts out a lot of the fat. Mm-hmm. And so for me, what this book was not grabbing people's attention. And so I started, as you do, you start turning the idea over in your head. And one of the things I noticed was I was creating this file on my computer of all these other facts about trails that I'd started noticing. Things about insect trails, for example, ant pheromone trails, things about game trails and hunters, and all these historical pieces of trivia that I was collecting in this file. And this file just got bigger and bigger and bigger until I finally realized it was almost like, I often describe it as an iceberg turning over, that the amount of information I had about trails was much bigger than the amount I had about the Appalachian Trail. And the whole idea flipped over, and I realized that I should be writing a book about trails, with the Appalachian Trail being a small part of that rather than the inverse. And as soon as that idea clicked into place, I felt this surge of energy. When you're a writer, I think you're always attuned, whether consciously or unconsciously, to how much energy an idea has. And if an idea doesn't have a lot of energy, you have to create the energy yourself, through the writing, through the research, through the cleverness of your own mind. You have to create that energy, and it's a lot harder than if something has a natural, inherent energy to it. Mm-hmm. And this idea just had that energy. I felt this surge, and I went, of course, and looked online and wanted to know if anyone else had written a book like that. And at that time, no one else had. Now, a few years into my writing, Robert McFarlane released The Old Ways, which is, as far as I know, the only book about trails as a subject that has come out that preceded mine. But that book was very different from what I was writing. And so I felt good that there was a space for a book like this in the world.
Yeah, but again, trails in itself also seems at first glance to be a pretty challenging topic to cover. It's on the one hand very specific, and on the other hand, pretty broad. So how did you determine the particular subjects you would cover in the book?
It was a challenge. I'll be honest. And people still to this day, every time I give a reading, they ask me, well, why didn't you cover flight paths of birds? Or why didn't you cover the migration patterns of whales? And it's like I had to draw the line somewhere, that this is such a vast topic. But the thing that I finally keyed into, and the reason why I don't cover the flight paths of birds or the migration patterns of whales, is because I was looking at times when you were a mark was left in passing, and that mark was picked up by another person. I think that's the essence of a trill, another person or another animal. So in walking, you leave a footstep, someone else sees that footstep, and they follow your footsteps. And in following those footsteps, they leave their own footsteps, and you start to create a trail. And it's that feedback loop of leaving these signs upon the earth, which in my mind creates the essence of a trail and really the beauty of a trail, because that's how the sort of evolutionary process begins. And so then I looked around and I said, well, there's, you know, you still find that everywhere. You find it from the insects to the, you know, to various mammals and to obviously all kinds of human beings stretching back throughout history. And so I began to organize the information essentially by size and by time scale, you know, with some slight variations, but trying to start with the very ancient and very tiny and then moving up to the very vast and postmodern.
In the very first chapter, you also talk about the challenges that occur when trails are absent, so when getting lost. And you write, I vow to myself that if I made it out of this alive, I would never hike again. What had happened there?
I think that everyone has felt that at some time. Maybe not everyone, but anyone who spent enough time hiking has gotten themselves into a hairy situation where they think, I am never doing this again. What is the point of this? And at that point, I had found myself in Newfoundland amid these horribly gnarled trees called Tuckamore on top of a ridge during a thunderstorm, crouching on my heels out in the rain, you know, afraid for my life. And I just thought, what's the point of this? Why am I doing this to myself? Of course, it didn't prove to be true. You know, it's the same as many people after a hard night of drinking say, I'm never doing this again. And then the next week, they're right back to it. I'm a bit like that with hiking. I always tend to come back to it.
Yeah. And indeed, when you rediscovered the trail, you were pretty relieved, of course. And you wrote, the trail, however rough, would return me to the human realm. Delivered from chaos, I promptly forgot my former terror, fell in love with the earth anew, and once again desire to walk every inch of it. And I think that fits pretty well with the sentiment with which you start chapter one, where you write that it is actually impossible to fully appreciate the value of a trail until you have been forced to walk through the wilderness without one.
Yeah, I think that many hikers probably don't even pay attention to how often they're on, what their idea of hiking is in fact trail walking. Mm-hmm. That, you know, how infrequently we go cross country. And of course, I've done other trips starting from when I was a teenager where I've been walking cross country with a map and compass and being forced to navigate on my own. And some of those were really rewarding and some of them were very challenging. But it wasn't until I went to Newfoundland where the land was so rough and was so, there was so much friction to the walking that I really realized how beautiful a trail really is.
And as you have just said, you explored the topic of trails for your book, from small trails to big trails, from old trails to new trails. And you, besides others, tried to find the oldest trails on Earth. Where did you look for them?
So in my research, I discovered that the oldest trails that we currently know of are in a place called Mistaken Point in Newfoundland, which is the southeastern corner of Newfoundland. There are these tiny fossil trails left behind by an organism called Ediacara biota, which is unfathomably ancient animals. I want to say 454 million years ago, something like that, maybe 500 million. You might remember better than I do. It's been a while since I wrote that chapter, but hundreds of millions of years ago, these animals, which are barely animals at that point, they barely have the ability of locomotion, but they had enough musculature to kind of drag themselves along the ocean floor and left these very fine trails in the sediment, which look almost as if you dragged a pencil eraser along through some clay, some wet clay, and those were managed to be preserved because of a volcanic eruption. And provide to us the earliest signs of an animal leaving a trail. Now, we don't know really why they left it. We don't even really know the body plan of the animal that left it behind. But what we do know is even hundreds of millions of years ago, animals were trying to move and in the process were leaving trails behind them as they went.
Yeah, it's a fascinating chapter. A bit later in the book, you write about insect trails, and you tell an anecdote about a guy who did a little experiment with ants on the brim of his bathtub. What did that experiment look like?
Yeah, so this is the physicist Richard Feynman, who is famous for his wide-ranging curiosity and scientific brilliance. But one day he was sitting in his house. He was sitting in the bathtub, I believe, and he noticed these ants walking around his bathroom. And he decided to play a little game, to create a little experiment. So he takes a sugar cube and he puts it at one end of the bathtub, away from where the ants were. And he waited until the ants found this sugar cube. And of course, one ant walks across the bathtub, takes a little granule of sugar and starts walking back. And as the ant is walking back across the bathtub, he takes a colored pencil and he draws a line following its exact trail as it walked back along the bathtub. And as you might imagine, if you've ever watched ants walking, it was a very curvy, uneven, inelegant trail. It was wandering all over, trying to find its way back to the nest. But what happened is another ant came out, followed that ant's trail, found the sugar, started walking back to the nest. And as it started walking back to the nest, Feynman started tracing that ant's trail with his colored pencil as well. And what he found is with every curve, it was sort of shaving off the unnecessary turns, and it was making the trail a little bit sleeker. And he did that again and again and again with different colors of pencils until finally he found that the ants were following more or less a perfectly straight trail from the sugar cube back to the nest.
Yeah, I believe in a book you call this maximizing the collective intelligence.
Yeah, it's one of the amazing things about ants, right, is that individually they're not very smart, but collectively they're very smart. They can find the most efficient route across basically any landscape. They can solve transportation problems that, you know, some of our best computer scientists study to try to figure out how to route information through the internet. They'll look at ant trails, because if ants, these individually very stupid ants, can come up with these collectively very intelligent solutions, then we can do the same with computers.
Yeah, it's a very simple but also very profound example because it shows that trails do not necessarily only help the transport of people or animals, but it's really also a tool of communication, right? Especially for ants, but probably in a different sense also for bigger, more complex animals and humans.
I think that all trails are in a sense of a form of communication, because you're leaving signs behind you as you travel, and those signs are picked up, the signs and those signals are picked up by other animals, and ants, you know, it's particularly pronounced because if they find a bigger certain types of ants, at least fire ants, for example, if they find a bigger cache of food, they will get more excited, so they'll leave behind more pheromones. So there's actually a constantly updating map of where all the food is and how much food is there, just based on the pheromone signals. It's an incredibly elegant system, but it's also very, very effective, because as soon as that food source starts to dwindle, they'll leave less hormone behind. And so the next ant to find that trail can go, there's not that much food there. It's not really worth it. Whereas this new trail over here, there's a much stronger signal, so I'm going to go over there. And it becomes a kind of collective communication that's used, you know, created using these very, very simple, almost binary signals.
How about bigger and more complex animals, and how far is their trail making different?
Well, in some ways it's different. In some ways it's not at all. I mean, if you look at larger herd mammals, for example, they do pretty much the same thing. I spent time herding sheep in Arizona. And it's a similar type of deal with they find a really strong patch of grass or wildflowers that they like. They will be able to sniff it out, and more sheep will go find that patch of resources and will come back and will create a deeper trail. And that attracts more sheep the next time they go out from the pasture. So it's in that sense, it's very similar. Now, what's remarkable with larger animals is that they have a sense of memory, right? And so when you start looking at the really big animals like elephants, they can actually remember which trails go where, what they're used for. If it's somewhere you go during the rainy season, or if there's somewhere you go during the dry season, they can remember if there's a fence there. And so the trails become very intelligent in that sense, because they're tied to the individual intelligence of the animal in question.
And how about us humans? You, for example, you, of course, it's a big topic. You wrote many, many pages about it. But besides many others, you talked to quite a few Native American communities about their traditions surrounding trails. What did you learn from them?
This is where trails become really quite profound, because trails throughout indigenous communities are tied into the ways that that stories are told and information is passed down. And this is something I didn't know before researching this book, and it never really occurred to me, is that one of the reasons why, if you've ever spent time reading indigenous folk tales from pretty much any culture, there's always a strange quality to them. Like there's always seems to be almost too much extraneous information and not as much of a narrative arc as we would like. And part of that is because they have different cultural expectations of what a story should accomplish. But also it's because almost everywhere that you look at indigenous storytelling, that those stories are tied to specific places in the land. Those are not placeless stories. It's not once upon a time in a forest there was a little girl wearing a red cloak. It's once upon a time in this forest, right here, where we're standing, there was a little girl wearing a red cloak, and she went there, and then she went there, and she gathered these resources, and she had to hide from this animal. And all of it is investing the landscape with meaning, and it's teaching you about how that landscape can be navigated and how that landscape can be used. And so when you talk to, for example, Cherokee folklore experts, what they'll say is these stories followed the trails. There were trails leading you where these stories went. And in the case of Aboriginal Australians, it's the most incredible example of all, because the trails were the stories. If you've ever heard of the Aboriginal song lines, these were songs that they would sing to themselves while they walked that would actually describe the landscape. And it would allow them to navigate for hundreds or even thousands of miles all the way across the continent, just using these stories.
Yeah, I think what you just said is a beautiful example of the meaning of trails for cultures, for societies, in this case, Cherokee or Aborigine tribes. But the interesting thing is that trails or paths, they play a role actually in almost any culture or religion, right? I mean, they serve as a metaphor, and they serve as symbols for a path to enlightenment, for example, or whatever it might be. So they are really an integral part of many, many traditions. And maybe today, compared to that, we have lost track a little bit of the actual meanings paths can have for us.
Yeah, I think we don't walk on paths as often as we did once. And so the metaphors that they were tied to don't really make sense to us as much. You know, when we say stick to the straight path, the straight and narrow, you know, there are many religious parables that speak of the crooked path. And that just seems kind of fanciful to us now. And in fact, nowadays, we kind of like crooked paths. I see photographs, landscape photographs, all the time of crooked paths that make no sense, but they look really beautiful to our eye. And that's because we don't have to walk those trails every day to carry, you know, a big load of a 100-pound load of rice on our back from the other side of the valley. Nowadays, it's just purely aesthetic. So we've gotten pretty distant from trails, but they survive in our language, in our metaphors, in our religions. You know, the Tao means the way. There's the middle path in Buddhism. The metaphor of the path or the trail runs thick throughout the Bible and the Quran. Most religions, you will find some reference to this because, you know, at one point we were all on trails, and so we would understand that metaphor. That would be a very deep, very powerful metaphor to us.
Yeah, I like how you just talked about how we perceive trails. They used to be more winding and meandering, and today this pleases our eye because, yeah, it's pretty different from the very high degree of efficiency that we usually try to achieve with almost anything we do today, even maximizing our free time or our holidays or something like that. And I think like a reason for that probably is that the generation of trails or the making of trails used to be a very organic as an approach, right? Like you talked about how insects or animals like elephants created trails through trial and error, through communication, then slowly optimizing them. But in the end, they still somehow weave through the landscape. But that's not really how we create our trails today, right? Today, if we build a road or a railway, it's, for lack of a better word, it's much less organic.
I think you're right, especially in the way that the highway and the railway, which are both such sort of unnaturally straight and fast forms of transportation, such fast structures, they become very ugly to us, right? And they're also very fixed, right? In the sense that trails are always evolving with each person who takes a step. The highway or the railway is not evolving. It may be devolving slightly because it's sort of eroding, but it's certainly not improving. And so because we've reached really the pinnacle of land-based efficiency in terms of travel, now we're starting to cherish ways that are a little bit slower, a little bit less efficient. But one thing that's interesting is when I went looking for Cherokee trails in the mountains with this man named Lamar Marshall, who maps, he's making a map of all the ancient Cherokee trails in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. What I found was those trails, when they go over a mountain, go quite straight. They're actually going basically straight up the mountain along the fall line in a way that modern hikers would find really uncomfortable, because our trails tend to have switchbacks, which lead you gradually up the trail. And the reason why they do that is so that they'll shed water and they won't create too much erosion. Mm-hmm. Also, because it's easier for, you know, older hikers or hikers who aren't as strong. But the Cherokee were incredibly strong. They were incredibly strong hikers and runners. They could grip the ground through their moccasins with their toes. This is what Lamar Marshall told me. So they almost had like Vibram five-finger shoes, you know, those barefoot running shoes. Mm-hmm. They would grip the ground as they were hiking. So their trails went straight up a mountain pass and straight down the other side. So the really windy trail is actually a kind of modern artifact, not an ancient one.
Now, okay, that's interesting. So basically that means what you talked about in terms of how we perceive highways and railroads as rather ugly, that probably results from the fact that they detach us a bit from nature. But on the other hand, some traditional trails, they actually were very efficient as well.
That's right. And I think that the difference is that even if you are on a Cherokee trail walking barefoot or walking in moccasins, you could go as quickly as possible. And oftentimes they were running, you know, for various reasons, to transport messages, or if they were, you know, about to go into war. But they were still very connected to the landscape. You know, you're still moving at a human scale. And I think that once you reach the speed of automobiles and trains, you arrive at a point of rupture, especially airplanes. You arrive at a point of rupture where we really become disconnected from the environment. It becomes a blur, a literal blur. And I think that that rupture leaves in us a desire for something, a desire for context and a desire for connection to the environment. And I think that's a big hole in our psyche that we're trying to fill in all sorts of ways.
Beyond that, do you think that the early trails, for example, of animals or even of humans, do they have anything to do with what a modern technology provides in terms of trails? What I'm referring to is that in a book you write about topics that at first glance don't have a lot to do with what we talked about so far, for example, the internet.
Yeah, I think that the internet is, in a certain sense, a trail system. It's a way of connecting various places and passing information along. And so when you look at old trails or old roads, those were the means of communication for those neighborhoods, for those areas, for those villages. One of the people I talked to in the book was a colonial road scholar. And one of the things he told me was that old roads in North Carolina, throughout the East Coast of the United States in the 1700s, if you find houses, they will always be very close to those roads. And the reason why is because information was passing along that road. If someone was, you know, coming by in their wagon, you'd invite them in, you'd give them a drink or give them a bite of food to eat, and you'd ask them about the local news, the local gossip. That's how you got your information. Before we had the radio, before we had newspapers, they all was tied to trails. And that's true in indigenous societies as well. And so now with the internet, we really have this massive global trail network where information is passing so quickly that it's really kind of starting to spiral out of control. We can't even handle the rapid influx of all this information.
Yeah, it's very interesting the different shapes and forms and meanings trails can have. They can be challenging today if we talk about digitalization, but we also talked quite a bit about them providing comfort and efficiency especially when we follow them as hikers. The interesting thing about that, and you also point that out in your book, is that actually, on the other hand, we are all told and taught in school and elsewhere to be leaders and to be trailblazers and not necessarily to follow trails that already exist, especially in life in general, to be successful.
I think I hesitate to extend this to all cultures because I don't know well enough how much kids are brought up, but it sounds like they are in Germany as well, and I know they are in the United States and in Canada and in Australia and places where I've lived, is that kids are brought up saying, you know, don't be a follower. Go, you know, you need to go and find your own path in life. You need to be a trailblazer. You need to be someone who's a pioneer. All of these words suggest that we shouldn't be following the paths of others. And in fact, a great premium is placed on the people who go out on their own into the intellectual wilderness and discover a new idea or discover a new art form, a new way of expressing yourself. I know that I went to a fiction program at a school called Brown, which is a liberal arts college, which is known for being highly creative and highly, you know, sort of experimental in the type of writing that it teaches. And that was when I was getting my degree. The worst thing someone could tell you that your work was conventional or cliched. Mm. You know, these were the most vicious, stinging barbs, was that you were doing something that someone else was doing. There was a great, great premium placed on coming up with an original voice and an original vision. And I think that that's a good thing to a point. However, I think it can also become paralyzing. I know it was paralyzing for me in my own writing, trying to write fiction, having the weight of all of the other books that had ever been written as counterexamples. I couldn't do that. Those were all trails that I could not follow. I couldn't follow any of them. I had to find my own path in this sort of wilderness of pre-existing trails. That's not very generative. That's not very helpful for a writer, and I don't think it's helpful for most thinkers. I think most thinkers benefit from following a path that someone else has laid out, you know, whether that's a school of art or a way of thinking, a philosophy, a science, a field of research, and then you follow that trail to its outer edges, and then you launch forth into the wilderness from there. You don't start from the beginning. You don't say, I'm going to invent my own language. You don't say, I'm going to invent my own ideas from scratch, unless you're one of those rare, rare geniuses who's able to do that. But that's a very, very perilous approach to any kind of intellectual endeavor, I think.
Yeah, and if we talk about not intellectual endeavors, but actually bring it back to hiking, the interesting thing, of course, is that actually we want hikers to follow the trails, right? Especially since most or many of the trails, especially the famous ones like the Appalachian Trail, have now become really famous, really popular, and really pretty widely used. Many people want to enjoy them, and yeah, in order to protect them and the surrounding nature and environment, people have to stick to the trails.
Yeah, that was that. You know, growing up, I was always taught that you're not supposed to leave the trail. You're not supposed to hike. For example, if the trail gets all bogged down in mud, you're not supposed to try and walk around it. You're just supposed to go through the middle and get muddy, because if you try and go around it, you're going to just widen the muddy area. But when I was on the Appalachian Trail, I actually started to diverge from that a little bit. I was wearing running shoes, and so I would diverge. If there was a big muddy patch in the middle of a trail, I would just tiptoe around it, or I'd go through the woods. I was pretty bad in some sense. Mm-hmm. And there's a part of me that wants to believe that, in fact, by doing that, what you're doing is showing the trail designers that some work needs to be done here, right? The trail crew can come through, and if they see that a bunch of people are skirting around this particular area of trail, they know we got to put down some kind of footbridge here, or we need to come up with an alternate trail. And so, in a sense, I know that hikers are supposed to, ethically speaking, stick to the trail. But realistically speaking, I also know that most of them won't. And I try to keep that in mind. That's a really important thing, I think, for most environmental planners or people who work in any kind of environmentally related field to keep in mind. We tend to think that just by scolding people and setting down ethical rules, people will follow it. But the fact is, most people won't. You know, most people are driven by this very, very basic, very animal desire to minimize wasted time and wasted energy. And this is something I learned writing about trails. That's not a human thing, and that's certainly not a Western human thing or a, you know, modern affluent human thing. That's an animal thing. We don't want to waste our energy. And so we can't create structures for people which are really inefficient or annoying. A little example of this is I live in the out in the forest in British Columbia. And where I live now, you don't get your recycling picked up. You have to drive your recycling to a recycling center, right? Mm-hmm. And this recycling center closes. They used to close at 5 p.m. Now they close at 4:30 p.m., which is the time most people get off from work. So it's incredibly frustrating because the moment they get off from work, they want to try and drop off their recycling and they're already closed. What's happened is initially people kicked a hole through the fence. There was a wooden fence and they kicked a couple of the slats out so they could sneak into the recycling center at night and dump the recycling and then leave. And now what's happened is so many people had done that they just left a gap in the fence. And now people go in at night. They're not technically supposed to, but who are they hurting? You know, they're not hurting anyone. In fact, they're doing something good. And that's the kind of thing, those types of systems where they allow a little bit of flexibility, I really like that. I prefer that to a sort of authoritarian, top-down, don't do this, you must do this form of environmental stewardship or any form of social planning, because I think it's destined to fail.
Are these the kind of thoughts that accompanied you on big portions of the trail, like thinking about where to go specifically, like in a boggy section, for example, and the message that would send to a very small degree to the trail designers? Of course, I mean, it's also an intellectual exercise because in the end, one person doesn't make a big difference in this case. But if you perceive yourself to be a part of a group, of a social group, of a community, and if many people do the same thing, of course, at some point, the trail changes and every little individual contributes a little bit to it. But of course, thinking like this is also pretty strategic on a day-to-day basis, right? To think about where do I go? What will that contribute to the trail and how will it change it?
Yeah, I think that I thought about it more to the degree I thought about it on the trail. I probably thought about it as, am I being a good person or a bad person? Am I being a good hiker or a bad hiker? And if I was going around the edge of the muddy puddle, I was being a bad hiker. But most of the time, I wasn't thinking about it consciously in terms of where I put my feet. When you begin to think about it consciously is once you get to the shelter, because at the shelters, they have these things called trail logs, which are journals that someone leaves at every lean-to along the Appalachian Trail. And people will go in there and they write about their day. They say, you know, a great weather and met this person. They just write little summaries of their hike that day. But what they also do is they will speak directly to the trail crews and they'll say, this section of trail is terrible. You know, this section of trail was really inconvenient or is too steep. You know, hikers really become critics at some point of the quality of the trail. And nothing is more frustrating than when you're following the trail and suddenly the trail vanishes. And there's no trail markers. You're just in a field of boulders or maybe you're in a grove of trees. You can't tell where the trail is and you have to backtrack to try to figure out where it is. And really all that can happen is if they forget to put one blaze, one mark of paint on a tree, suddenly for you, the trail has vanished. And this infuriates hikers because it breaks the flow. It breaks up your, you know, you have to stop and waste time. And it's really kind of, on an existential level, really unsettling, right? Because this thing you've been clinging to, this lifeline, has vanished. And so it's a really funny thing if you pay attention to trail logs, because you'll oftentimes find hikers complaining about precisely that and trying to improve the trail.
But it also sounds a little bit like they have some sense of entitlement after following this trail for quite some time and
enormous entitlement. It's actually quite hilarious because now I've spent time on both sides of the fence. I've also worked as a trail builder. I spent a good deal of time volunteering on trail crews, and there's a great deal of frustration among trail crews and trail designers with the hikers because they say, oh, the hikers are so selfish and the hikers are so entitled. The hikers don't want to get their boots wet or they don't want to walk up stairs. So they'll walk alongside the stairs and they create these eroded kind of sluiceways that water comes down. And so there's a real antagonistic relationship to a certain degree between the hikers and the trail builders. One funny thing that a trail builder told me was, he said, you know, they refer to it as hiker management. That's how you psychologically deal with hikers, right? So hiker management is, if hikers want to, for example, follow a trail, they may throw a big pile of branches on that trail, or they may put some rocks there that they call gargoyles to scare the hiker from following that trail rather than the other trail where the trail builder wants them to go. And this becomes especially important going up a steep hill, right? Because the trail builder wants you to follow these switchbacks, whereas the hiker, especially coming down, just wants to cut a straight line. So they spend a lot of time with these little psychological tricks to force the hiker on the trail. And one of the trail builders told me, he said, you know, this whole hiker management thing would be a lot easier if we just got rid of the hikers.
Very good. Yeah,
he just wants to build a beautiful trail with no people on it. I mean, that's sort of where you end up when you build these things, because people are frustrating. You know, people are incredibly rebellious and frustrating.
It's actually, you know, if you think about it and the way you talk about it, it's a really interesting, what's the word, symbiosis, right, between the two, ever changing, always somehow keeping in balance. Hating each other, loving each other, needing each other, impacting each other. You talked about how you try to, you know, very subtly send messages to the trail makers. The trail makers try to steer the hikers. It's a pretty interesting relationship.
It is. I mean, it's made me think a lot about the relationship between an author and a reader. You know, it's analogous in many ways. The difference is I have no way of getting feedback from readers, or at least that was true up until recently. Now there's all these interesting subtle ways where you get, because of social media, because of, you know, for example, on the Kindle, you can see which passages people have highlighted most often, which is interesting. You're getting these little pings of feedback. And then in my book, in the last pages, I included my email address so that writers can actually write to me, or readers can actually write to me with their feedback. And I've gotten so many interesting stories, really helpful corrections, factual corrections, typos. And each time those come in, I update the file so that when the new edition comes out, the book will get a little bit better. Just like a trail, it will improve a little bit each time it comes out. And it's my dream to just continue updating this book until I die, you know, just allowing it to get a little bit more elegant with each subsequent edition.
Beautiful. Yeah. Yeah. It's a trail in itself. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, coming to an end, I'd like to read two very brief excerpts from the epilogue, if you don't mind, and ask you for an elaboration in each case.
Okay.
In the end, we are all existential pathfinders. We select among the paths life affords, and then, when those paths no longer work for us, we edit them and innovate as necessary. The tricky part is that while we are editing our trails are also editing us, unquote. Were you able to witness that phenomenon on the AT as well?
I think that this is something you witness all the time. It's just that we don't pay a whole lot of attention to it. You know, I think about, I mean, I was someone who was raised without religion, for example. I was never baptized. My parents are sort of agnostic, and I was raised agnostic. And so from a young age, I was reading widely in different texts, trying to figure out what my religion would be. I remember my sister had a comparative religion textbook. She's 9 years older than me. So when she was in high school, I was a preteen. And I'm sorry, when she was in college, I was a preteen. And I was thinking about, you know, do I want to be a Taoist? Do I want to be a Buddhist? Do I want to be Amish? You know, do I want to be any of these various ways of being, which were all so different? It was very clear to me that these were very distinct paths that you could take. And as I describe in the book, the tricky thing is, as you start to set off down one path, that starts to change you. You know, what language you speak, that shapes your mind. What religion you follow, suddenly you'll start to see the other religions in a different way, right? If you're for example, I spent a lot of time studying Buddhism. If you're a Mahayana Buddhist, you regard other types of Buddhists, the Theravada Buddhists, they call them Hinayana, the lesser vehicle. If you're a Theravada Buddhist, you regard the Mahayana Buddhists as kind of arrogant and grandiose and, you know, as they say, not really Buddhism. All of these different paths that we follow have ways of shaping our outlook and our way of looking at other paths and our ways of being. You become a different person. When you're a person raised under capitalism, you become a different person than if you're raised in an indigenous traditional society, or if you're a person raised under communism. All of these ways of being we follow in our life are ways of shaping ourselves and structuring the world, reducing the chaos of the world and the scariness of the world down to a clear line. But it's not an easy question, what path you're going to take in life, what career you're going to follow, what belief system you're going to follow. It's really the challenge of a lifetime.
Yeah, that's actually pretty much the second quote. We don't even have to completely discuss it anew anymore. But in that, you write, the same rule applies to our life's pathways. Collectively, we shape them, but individually, they shape us. So probably on a very simple note, or in a very simple way, we could, for example, say, we shape pathways such as professions. We as humans have created the job of a teacher and what it means to be a teacher today, for example, in the USA or Canada. We have shaped that collectively. But once we choose to follow this profession, what we study and the experiences that we have in front of a class, for example, that will shape us as a person.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely, that's it. You've nailed it. I mean, you think about how differently you're going to look at life if you are, you know, for example, someone just that studies chemistry, right? You see everything in the world as chemistry. Oftentimes speaking to physicists, I'm amazed by their belief that everything is just physics. They see everything through that lens. Whereas if you're a poet or if you're a construction worker, you're going to see the world very differently. I was recently walking through the forest with a forester, and he says he can look at a forest and just see board feet. He can just see feet of lumber by glancing at a forest. Mm. I'm fascinated by the ways that our experiences shape the way we look at the world. And that's really what drove me to want to be a journalist, is that I love meeting new people and seeing the way they see the world and how their experiences have shaped the way that they see the world. That's just endlessly interesting and fascinating and enlightening to me.
Yeah, and that's reason enough. And that's also what you point out in the book. It's reason enough to choose our paths wisely, not only while hiking, but also in life in general.
That's right. Yeah,
very nice. Okay, Robert, to really come to an end now, if you don't mind, I would like to finish up with a little lightning round. So I would just read a few quick prompts and you could answer to that as briefly as you want, but of course you can also talk a little bit more about it just as you like.
Okay.
What I enjoy most about hiking is?
I mean, I guess freedom and wilderness, right? And as I said, freedom is a complicated word. I think it's more of a constrained freedom, but still freedom, and then just experiencing this world which is bigger than us and is beyond us and which resists us and inspires us.
One of the hardest parts of the book to write was probably?
I think it was probably the chapter on insect trails. I have no real background in science, and in fact, I'm pretty dumb when it comes to science and math. And so I had to really work hard to not get that because the chapter is about the fossil trails and insect trails are also about the history of science and the way that we make sense out of things using the scientific method. And so I had to start from the beginning. I think I probably spent a year just writing those two chapters, doing research into the history of science and specifically into the history of entomology and fossil science. It's very tough, complicated stuff. And so that was hard.
One of the scientists that I met for this book, whose work was particularly fascinating to me, was?
Oh, man, there are so many. But I think that the people who study collective intelligence are really quite fascinating. Two people I would highlight. One is named Ian Couzin, Couzin, and the other is Audrey Dussoutour. They both study collective intelligence in ants and in flocks of birds or schools of fish or slime molds, which are fascinating. You know, these single-celled organisms that can manage to solve mazes. If you go, you can even look on their Twitter feeds, and they've got great videos, time-lapse videos of slime molds exploring mazes or reaching out to recreate the Tokyo subway system. Those guys are doing such fascinating work and just right on the outer edge of what we can understand about how simple things create really intelligent designs.
When I tried to herd some sheep while on research for the book...
it did not go well. Is that what you're expecting?
I guess,
I managed to, on my very first day of herding sheep with this Navajo family I was living with, I managed to lose every single sheep, which was very embarrassing. Thankfully, they were all recovered and I got somewhat better, but that was a bad first day.
Yes, very nice. It was a very bad first day, but it's a very nice and light note to end the conversation. I think one of the underlying questions of the book is a pretty challenging one. Whoever wants to really understand how the book answers it, I think we touched upon some aspects, should read it. It is, how do we make sense of chaos? And as far as I know, you will continue to explore this question in a future project, won't you?
I will, yeah. I am currently. I'm currently writing a book called In Trees, which mm-hmm. is about essentially people who live in trees and people who think in trees. So people who are spending their time in the treetops, whether that's treetop protesters or arborists or tree climbers, or people who are thinking in trees, people who are tracing family trees or linguistic trees or the evolutionary tree of life. All these various ways that we navigate chaos using branches and branching structures. That's what the next book is going to be about.
And I think you will have good chances again for German translation, because the subject of trees has been very successful and popular in Germany on the German market for a couple of years now.
Yeah, one of the people I spoke to for my book is Peter Wohlleben.
Yeah, exactly.
He started this whole thing. Who has been massively successful. Yeah, the success of that book is really incredible. It's a phenomenon.
Yeah. Great. How can we best follow what you're up to and how the new project is going and when it is being released?
Yeah, so if you want to follow me on Twitter, my handle is at Robert Moore, M-O-O-R underscore, all one word. Or, you can, like I said, if you buy the book, my email is in the back. So mm-hmm. if you want to keep in touch with me that way, you can do that as well.
Great. Well, thank you so much. That was a really, really great conversation, just as great as the book was. I really, really enjoyed it. And I'm not just saying it, but it's really true. I really highly recommend it. And I appreciate the time that you have taken. And I already want to plug that and try to put you in a bad spot. I also would really love it if we could have another conversation once your next project is out.
Of course. Yeah, I really enjoyed this. This was great. Thank you so much for your question.
Thank you. Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.